All right. So for those of you that aren't from the biosolids world, I want to make sure that we're talking about apples and apples. So when we're talking about biosolids, we're talking about only solids from municipal wastewater treatment. We're not talking about manure or other organics that would be excellent soil amendments or fertilizers, but in this case, we're just looking narrowly at this particular category of material. So the heat drying business comes in because society has a need to deal with wastewater residuals or biosolids, and people are getting more and more concerned about human pathogens in the material. So a lot of the new treatment plants, as they upgrade, they go to a process that produces what EPA calls a Class A material, which is a material that you could sell at a department store. It essentially has no pathogen issues. And so the other reason why you might want to do heat drying is that maybe you want to create a product that can be used in an urban area. So there's more of this heat drying going on. Used to be just milorganite for about 70 years, but in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen a lot of increasing use of heat drying as a technology for processing biosolids to reach this Class A material. The one I'm going to be talking about today is a product called SoundGrow. It's produced in Pierce County, Washington. The city of Tacoma is part of that service area. The temperatures are quite hot in the dryer, up to 480 degrees C. The pelleting process goes on, and you get a nice material that looks like a fertilizer pellet. They add some oil to reduce the dust, and they're selling it either as a bulk product or as a bag product. So as far as the farmers go, the reason why they might be interested in this form of biosolids or other forms of biosolids are that with the fertilizer prices being what they are, they're looking for alternatives. The biosolids have actually been used in the Pacific Northwest for quite a few years, east of the Cascade Mountains in the dry parts of the state, for about 15 years or more. There's a different situation as far as nitrogen there, though. In that region, you can put on biosolids during a summer fallow and then plant your crop, and you won't lose any nitrate that's formed in the fall over the winter. In contrast to that, in western Oregon, we're blessed with about 40 inches of annual rainfall, with about 30 of that coming during the winter. So if you're a nitrate molecule in November, you're going to be washed out of the root zone by the next spring. Some information on other studies with heat-dried materials. First, our extension guidance, which is based on other kinds of drying, either air drying or, well, that's the main kind of drying, or dewatering, which is not really dewatering. You still have 80% water. Those kinds of materials, we predict that 30 to 40% of the organic nitrogen will mineralize during the first year after application. One of the reasons why I was interested in working with a heat-dried product was that I read a paper from the UK where they had a number of different materials, and they were showing some pretty high mineralization rates, up to 2 times greater for the same solids after you heat dried them. Apparently the heat drying changed the organic nitrogen form, so it was more mineralizable. And my colleague at Puyallup, Washington, also on the west side of the Cascades, measured a pretty high nitrogen availability from this SoundGrow product. So our objectives are pretty simple: to look at the plant available nitrogen release from the heat-dried material, and look at 2 times of application, the fall application and a spring application. So here's our rates covering the range of nitrogen rates, so we get a nice response curve. And we're putting this on pre-plant before seeding, or in the spring during the tillering growth stage. And this material is kind of interesting for looking at organic nitrogen mineralization in that you don't really have any ammonium nitrogen. So here's our field site. We're on a nice silt loam soil, a mollisol, and we're at a soil test value that all we need is nitrogen. We also apply sulfur across all the plots to make sure we don't have a sulfur response. So with the fall application, we see quite a early season vegetative growth response with the wheat. As you can see here, you've got a lot more height of the wheat, and you've got a lot more tillering of the wheat. So we're determining equivalency as with two measures that I'll show you today. One is just a straight determination of relative yields, and the other is a determination of green nitrogen uptake. So the green nitrogen uptake, we get that by measuring protein using a near-infrared sensor and converting that number to total nitrogen. We checked the calibration of that and found pretty much dead-on agreement with a LECO nitrogen analysis. So we feel pretty confident that the protein is a good way to get nitrogen numbers on grain. So the first year, we're growing a variety called Tubbs, and we're at some pretty high yield levels, as you can see here. And Tubbs has the fault of lodging when you get higher nitrogen rates. So you can see that we reach a peak with the urea and we drop off. So this line here, which is going to be in all these graphs, is a line that I drew across the center of the response function. And so what I'm calling equivalency here is, for instance, we're here with urea and we're here with this material, and we look at where these things intersect the x-axis. So I've done that here, and for the yield we get about 42% for the spring application of the heat-dried biosolids, the sound grow, with the fall application 35%. If we use the grain nitrogen uptake as our index of equivalency, we get some numbers that are pretty close to the same numbers. The grain nitrogen has the advantage is that usually it's more linear, so you avoid a problem like this where you run into a cliff and your yield plummets because of some problem at high nitrogen rates. The following year, we repeated the same study, and we ran into a rather severe case of stripe rust disease and also septoria disease. And as it turned out, plants that were greener, that had bigger leaves, and had higher rates of nitrogen tended to have a more severe case of stripe rust. So this is showing you kind of how that played out. Over here, I've got a shot of our highest urea rate versus a similar rate with the fall biosolids, which of course has less available nitrogen. So this complicated the interpretation of data from that year. Also want to point out that with the fall material, you get accelerated plant development, so you're really at a different growth stage with the fall application here than you are with urea, even though the calendar date's the same. So here's our grain data that came from that. And the previous year, we were at 10 metric tons per hectare. Here, we're only at 5. So a tremendous yield hit on stripe rust and septoria in that year. The interesting thing, though, is that really the relative performance of our biosolids to urea wasn't tremendously different than the previous year. We get a little bit better performance, I think, out of the biosolids in this year because of the factor I mentioned earlier that, generally speaking, you're not getting leaves that are as big and green and therefore probably not as good a substrate for stripe rust. So this had no fungicide in 2010. The next year, 2011, this year, we did the same experiment, and this year I noticed that the product that I got had a little bit more oil on the pellets than in previous years. So when I went out to the field about 3 weeks after applying, and we had lots of rain, so it should have kind of broken up and looked like it did in previous years, but this year you could still see pellets, and you could still see pellets at the harvest time too. So I think part of what goes on with this in 2011 is that we have a lot of product that just didn't get into the soya. So here's our yield response for 2011. In terms of relative yields, it looks like the first year we did things. This year we've got fungicide sprayed, so we've kept the leaf disease problem at bay, same variety as the previous year. And you can see here's our relative nitrogen equivalency. So over the 3 years that we've done this, here's the summary of the results, that in the red we've got the fall application, and the green is the spring application, and our average over those 3 years is about 35% availability for the fall application and about 45% for the spring. So there is undoubtedly some nitrogen that gets lost between a fall application and the rapid uptake phase for the wheat in our environment. We know that the fall application kind of runs out of gas, so to speak, or you know there isn't great carryover all the way through the stem elongation phase for wheat. The reason why we even tested here is because that's most likely going to be the application method that growers would use, because if you're applying a lot of material, and you get a lot of material with a 5% or 6% nitrogen material, they're going to be more likely to put that on in the fall than they are in the spring. The spring, we're getting 45% of the nitrogen relative to urea available, and that's actually pretty high considering that we only have 30 to 60 days after when we broadcast for that nitrogen to get into the plant to affect the yield. So I think relative to previous research where they showed numbers that were a lot higher, we might be showing the same thing. It's just that we have a shorter window for the mineralization to happen in the spring. So with that, I think I'm probably out of time. And Miguel, I can take questions if we have time for that, or?
We have time for a couple of questions.
Okay. Yes.
How did you determine how to draw the horizontal line?
That was by inspection, meaning that what I was looking for was kind of in the middle of the response curve. It really shouldn't make a difference if they're all linear. It only makes a difference where one of them is curvilinear. If you drew it farther up on the curve, then you would be kind of increasing the relative availability for the biosolids. So I was trying to be more fair about it and draw it down there. Yeah.
Were you on the same spots every year? Or did you go to?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mention that. Yes, we were on a different field every year. And we always followed oats as our previous crop to try and make sure that we're getting a system that'll be nitrogen responsive. Yeah, it's very important in this kind of work. Yeah.
Could I just change my question? What do you feel is the potential for that material? You're showing 35% to 45%.
Mm-hmm.
What is the potential down the road for continued release of that material if you were in the same field?
Okay, so the question is, this is all of my work shown today is for 1 year. What would happen if you, what would be the residual value of the biosolids for the nitrogen? We've done lots of work on this with other biosolids, and Craig Cogger in Washington did some residual work on tall fescue with this material. And for both this material and the other materials, it's about say 10% in the second year, and about 5% the third year, and about 3% year four, and so on. So it has a typical kind of decay curve. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.